Do that, but yeah. And I think we're ready to start.
I think that we are. What an awesome segue, talking about the deep look inside the integration services server. So we do have 1 minute. I'm actually going to wait until we have the tick on the clock over to 1:30, but we are just about ready to go.
And actually, some of this advanced content today, the slides you'll see, like in the text, you'll see like chapter 5 sample, right? That's actually, some of the stuff actually comes directly out of that book.
We good to go? Yeah, I hadn't hit anything, didn't tap the lab or anything. Fingers crossed. All right, so let's do our official introductions. My name is Matthew Roach. I'm a senior program manager on the SQL Server team at Microsoft. Before I joined Microsoft, I was a BI and data warehousing consultant. Spent about 5 years working in integration services, 80 hours a week for customers and clients around the world, doing both training, mentoring, and deployment. Used to be a SQL Server MVP, and Matt Mason actually convinced me to join the integration services team at TechEd 2 years ago.
Yeah, so my name is Matt Mason. I'm a program manager with the integration services team as well. I joined Microsoft around 2006, so right after the SQL 2005 release, and I've worked on SSIS since then. I've worked on design for 2008, 2012, and yeah, I really enjoy talking about SSIS and teaching people about SSIS. I'm excited to be here today.
So you've probably noticed at the conference a lot of sessions that have this phrase in the title: Windows deployment best practices, security best practices, best practices this, best practices that. I don't believe in it. I don't believe that best practices are best practices. And this is it's an idea that I've had in my mind for years, but back when I was a consultant, there was a conversation that really solidified this. I was flying home from Oklahoma, had a layover in Cincinnati, and I'm there at my gate, all worn out at the end of the week, and I see these two guys. They're obviously consultants at one of the big consulting firms. They've got their suits on, but their ties are loosened, and you got the young guy and the old guy, and the young guy is best practice this and best practice that. And after about 5 minutes, the older guy says, "Listen, all right, I know that you're eager, but there's no such thing as a best practice. What there are is there are best practitioners. And these are the people with the experience and the knowledge to build the best practices. Because all that a best practice is a generalized representation of this knowledge. Here's stuff. It's a rule of thumb, right? And it's great to know the rules of thumb. But once you know the information that went into the development of that rule, that elevates you above and beyond. And what I would like to call this, I didn't think about it until I'd already submitted the session, so I couldn't actually make it the official title. What we want to do is we want to have you guys leave here as SQL Server 2012 Integration Services Server Best Practitioners, or at least a big step closer towards this goal. We are going to be presenting information, concepts, details that will allow you to flesh out your understanding of the platform and apply it to a wide variety of problems. It is not a cookie-cutter cookbook. Here's a problem, here's a solution, here's a problem, here's a solution. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the platform, the details, the components, the design, the rationale, things along those lines, so that you can then take these, and when you get back into the office and you're saying, "Why the heck is it doing that?" you will then say, "Oh yeah, we've got these things and they work together in this way," and you will then be closer to that solution than you would otherwise be. So I want to say, just as sort of a segue, I love my car. I'd also like to say, as sort of a sad segue, this is not my car, but I couldn't find a stock photo of a Hyundai Elantra that we had the rights to use. So I love my car, drive it all the time. It's a 6-speed, great stereo, roll the windows down, love the weather. Seattle is great this time of year. It doesn't rain more than 20 hours a day. I don't know anything about how my car works. I give a lot of money to my mechanic. So I love my mechanic. She does a great job. You know, the car makes a noise. It's not accelerating as much as I'd like. You know, whatever, I take it in. I come back later in the day or I come back the next day. She gives me a car that purrs like a kitten. I give her money. But since I don't know what actually goes on the inside, I couldn't fix it myself. And I'm pretty much convinced that if I were to open up the trunk or open up the hood, that this is what I would see inside because this is what it sounds like, right? Now, you'd be amazed at how hard it is to find stock photos of integration services things. So here's a handsome guy in a data center. He knows how integration services work. So that didn't sound right. He understands the server. He understands the components. He's the mechanic, right? So he's the guy. He's the car owner who spends his weekends with the hood open, getting his hands greasy. He knows the pieces and the belts and the other automotive things. I don't know why I use automotive analogies. We want you to be more like this guy, because otherwise you will be giving more money to this guy. And this is sort of what we're going to be talking about today. Perhaps more specifically, this is what we're going to be talking around today. This is not our agenda. We're going to be talking about the components, the concepts, the interactions that underlie these things, because these are really the three big buckets of functionality and the three big buckets of pain that the integration services server addresses. And we'll hold the pain off for a second. Let's do a quick review.
Quick show of hands. How many people here are currently on 2012, using SSIS 2012? That's great. So more than half the room.
Really? I was going to say more like 30%.
Okay.
Sure. It's metric, half the room in metric.
Yeah, half the room in metric. Okay, good. Yeah. So this is an advanced topic, right? So if we move ahead, this is sort of the level setting that we want to do.
So essentially, if you don't... There we go. If this does not look familiar to you, don't leave, because they're still going to be very... No, sir, don't leave! There. Obviously, you can do as you need.
He got scared. He stopped and came back in.
So we assume that as in a 400-level session, we know that you know that the integration services server is implemented in our catalog database, this SSISDB database, that it has a host process, this isserverexec.exe, and that these are the two main components. You know that when you use the project deployment model, you are deploying to the server, and you know that this is an optional part of integration services in 2012. If you want, you can use the SQL Server 2012 bits and do things exactly like you did in the old versions. The only things that we've removed from the product are the ActiveX scripting and DTS compatibility, which have been deprecated forever. All of your other things will work. You don't need to do these things. You don't need to use the server. But all of the amazingly cool new capabilities introduced in SQL Server 2012 integration services depend on the server. So
when we were designing the server stuff, leading up to the 2012 release, we actually went out and talked to lots of different customers. And I think it was like 30 or 40 different customer visits we did. And we were collecting pain points. We wanted to know what was stressing people out. What were the biggest issues with SSIS? We ended up boiling that down to two main pillars for the 2012 release. We had a lot of features on the developer side, so improvements in bids, making it easier to learn, making it easier to use, making developers more productive. And the other side of the release went to the people who do the deployment and the management and the configuration of the SSIS packages. And to simplify that, all of our features revolve around this new SSIS catalog, which is the focus of today's talk. So the three main areas of functionality within the catalog is configuration. We want to centralize the configuration, but still make it similar enough to 2008 that people would easily grasp it and understand it. We focused on security, right? Now, I've never seen it myself, but I've heard some customers might see an error that says cannot decrypt package node or something like that. Obscure error, I'm sure you've never hit it. But if you have hit it, this will never happen in 2012 because we handle all the encryption for you automatically. It's basically seamless for you. And finally, there's a lot of management functionality in there. Built-in logging, easier execution with SQL agent, there's lots of troubleshooting functionality. So these are the three main areas that we're going to cover in the talk today.
And if you're looking at this, if you think about the things that you fight with, that you struggle with, that you swear at when you're using integration services in 2005 and 2008, odds are it falls into one of these three buckets. And the functionality that the server implements is designed to make it so both this common pain, this shared pain that as integration services professionals we've felt for so many years, and the duplicate work. You know, how many times have you implemented a logging framework or a monitoring framework or a deployment tool? You know, integration services has always had a great platform to build on and great tools, but you really needed to do that work yourself. And many people, many consultants, many companies have reinvented that wheel. And for the most part, we've made it round with the hole in the middle, which is good. But the fact that we've had to do that is not so good. So let's dive in. We'll take a look at the architecture from a couple perspectives. Here's sort of the 30,000-foot view. Let me call your attention to the two big blocks down at the bottom. On the left-hand side, we have our SQL Server instance. This is sqlserver.exe, the running Windows process behind the SQL Server database engine. And sir, with the camera in the front row, be aware that you do get the slides that you can download afterwards, so you can actually, okay, you can put them on your laptop and take a picture of that and get a better quality picture, though, so it's good. So I use that joke in every session. It's the only joke anyone ever actually laughs at. Yeah. So we've got our SQL Server instance running. Inside that, we have our SSIS catalog. So this is our SSIS DB database, which includes a SQL CLR assembly. So who's familiar with SQL CLR?
Anybody go to that talk this morning?
So Adam Mechanic did a talk on advanced SQL CLR. So maybe 10%, 15% on that. So the majority of people raise their hands about the SQL CLR, less than that about Adam's talk. We've implemented a great deal of functionality in SQL CLR, and one of the key things that SQL CLR assembly, which is an unsafe assembly, has the most permissions possible granted to it. The reason for that is a lot of the interactions are between the SQL CLR code inside the SQL Server database engine process and the execution process. This is the isserverexec.exe. Whenever you run a package, you know, whatever execution you're initiating will get its own execution instance. By default, all of the child packages will be inside that same execution host process, but the integration services catalog inside of the database, this is responsible for maintaining state. So you see it's got objects and logs and state and security. This is basically the operational store and the runtime store, whereas the execution process, it does the heavy lifting. This is where the data flow is running. This is where the control flow is running. All of the data access takes place to and from this execution process, and then these two are communicating back and forth, as we'll see in greater detail later on. If you look inside the catalog, inside the server, you'll notice there are five main buckets of functionality. The server exposes an API that's primarily exposed as Transact SQL, where we have, at the broadest marketing level, broken it down into deployment management, security, validation, and execution. And these are the basic categories of functionality that we expose. And we expose them through four primary APIs or four primary ways to communicate with it. There's a PowerShell API. There's the T-SQL API that you can get at through SQL Server Management Studio. We've got a deployment wizard. You can build custom applications. And there is this OM, we call it this our managed object model, or MOM, which is a .NET API, which is a wrapper on top of the underlying T-SQL. So pretty robust system. You can get to it in many ways.
Interesting. Side note, in our original design, we were actually embedding the whole SSIS runtime within the SQL Server process. And if you know SSIS internals, SSIS has a lot of native COM code, so we were actually running all that COM stuff within the SQL instance, which turned out to be a disastrous idea. And so we move it outside instead. So anything that touches the SSIS object model will always shell out to this separate process called isserverexec. Yeah.
And if you think about it, if your package crashes, that's often okay. You know, something goes wrong, isserverexec, or in the old days, dtexec, it might stop running. It's not catastrophic. You might need to start it again after the error has been resolved. If your database server crashes every time a package crashes, that would have been bad.
So yes, definitely.
I'm glad that you changed that design.
Not that SSIS ever crashes.
So the catalog, I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah.
The catalog is sort of at the heart, it's at the center of the server. So inside this SSIS DB database, the catalog, we've got stored procedures, views, table valued functions, et cetera, broken down into two different schemas. The first one is the catalog schema. Open it up in Management Studio, go looking around. It's just another database. It is a user database. The catalog schema is designed to be a public supported API. This is how we ask you to interact with the catalog, run these stored procedures, select from these views, and so on. The internal schema, on the other hand, you guys are curious, right? Go poking around there. Don't change it. Be aware that if you do things that are based on the internal schema, when we update the server, we will change this if we need to, and that will break your code. Not a supported API, but it's an interesting exploration. It's an interesting study if you want to. And if memory serves me correctly, when we updated from the RTM version to Service Pack 1, we've actually already made breaking changes to internal.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are some small changes. So yeah, catalog fully supported, internal, don't touch.
Everything that we do, if there's a sensitive value, we encrypt it. Used to be, you're thinking about your project, if I'm only connecting to things that are in a SQL Server database and I can rely on Windows authentication, then I don't need to worry about having a password stored anywhere, or if it's on a file server and I can just rely on Windows auth. But as soon as you had a username and password, you're connecting to an FTP server, maybe a third-party database server, as soon as you have this sensitive data, where is my secret store going to be? And we won't get into the old ways of approaching things. There's lots of different ways that you could address it. None of them were ideal. They all had pros and cons. In the catalog, any value that is marked as sensitive, it's automatically encrypted, it's automatically managed. We use the same key and certificate infrastructure that SQL Server implements. So we use their native keys. We've got the instance key and the database key and so on. This means that if you are doing a backup and restore of SSISDB to move from one instance to another, you need to backup and restore those keys as well. Otherwise, you will not be able to use the the catalog after you restore it.
Yeah, and so we'll talk about this on another slide too. I just want to call it out here. All of the encryption we do is transparent to you, or should be transparent to your users. And we basically support row-level security, so you can secure access at the project level, at the folder level, at the server level. And all that row-level security is built into our catalog views. So the internal tables, the internal views, don't have that row-level security applied. So it's another reason that anytime you're building an application or anything that accesses the catalog, to maintain that security, that row-level security, all access should be done through those catalog level, the views in the catalog schema.
So our final view of the catalog here, just looking more closely at the database, got some numbers that are up there. I want to focus on that SQL CLR assembly a little bit. Essentially, the SQL CLR assembly provides the communication shim to call out to isserverexec.exe and to do some things inside the database or inside the server, such as encryption. We have inside the database all these standard SQL Server objects. Outside the database, we've got our host process, where a lot of the functionality inside the host process is implemented in this integrationservices.server.shared.dll. If you go poking around the file system, this is something that you're going to walk into sooner or later. As we were going through the earlier design phases, we had scenarios where we saw this functionality possibly being exposed in multiple places, not just in the host process. Maybe we would have a way for the integration services runtime to be embedded in custom applications or other hypotheticals. By the time that we released it, we realized that customers weren't interested in those scenarios as priorities. So even though it's called shared, IS Server Exec is apparently a third grader. It doesn't share very well. If you pay attention to the experience, you'll notice a few other places where some of those future-proofing will shine through. So in Management Studio, for example, there is a node called Integration Services Catalogs, plural. How many catalogs can you have?
One.
Again, it was one of those scenarios that we thought would have value, but by the time that we were working with our early adopter customers moving up to release, we realized that it was a nice to have, but nobody really was asking for it. So not the thing to invest in.
It also complicated our upgrade scenario by a lot, so we ended up cutting it, but it was too late to make the UI changes by the time we cut it. So
when we're interacting with the catalog, three primary usage patterns. First one is the simple, boring one. You call a T-SQL object, stored procedure, table valued function, whatever. It's implemented in T-SQL because it's just selecting from or updating the tables. It does stuff inside a SQL server. It returns. It's done. We have a slightly more interesting one where the stored procedure or other object that you're calling is a T-SQL wrapper. It's an entry point stored procedure, but the functionality itself is actually implemented in the SQL CLR code inside that assembly. An example here would be encryption. When we are encrypting a project, and we'll see why later on, when you deploy a project, we're going to encrypt that whole project file. We're using the SQL CLR to do that part of the encryption story, but it's still contained inside the database. It's not doing any external communication. The interesting usage pattern is the one that comes down to things like executing or validating a package where the stored procedure that you're calling, again, it's a wrapper, so you've got the T-SQL wrapper around SQL CLR. That SQL CLR is going to call create process as user or create process impersonating the current user, creating the instance of isserverexec.exe. This can be either synchronous or asynchronous, depending on how you want it to run. You can simply do a fire and forget, and execution in your stored procedure will return, or execution in your SQL script will return, or you can run it synchronously so it will be blocking and you won't get control back until the end of the session, or until the end of the execution. And as for protecting data, I mentioned earlier both that we're using our built-in SQL Server encryption key structure. So we have our service master key, the database master key for SSISDB. And then whenever we have a project, an environment, or an execution, we're actually going to generate a certificate and a symmetric key from that and use that to encrypt any of the sensitive parameter or variable values throughout. The key thing is, even if it's something as ephemeral as the values that are being stored in a sensitive parameter or variable inside the package, we still need to store it as state, and we use this this key management infrastructure to ensure that that is never stored as plain text anywhere in the server. It's one of our overarching design principles. And even though I'm not going to try to read the T-SQL to you, essentially what we're doing inside our views and some of our other catalog schema objects is using the standard T-SQL key management capabilities. So we open the key, we decrypt using the key, we close the key, and all of this works because we have the row-level security inside our table saying that these users or these groups have access to these projects, these environments, these executions.
Yeah, so all, like I said earlier, all of our row-level security is implemented this way. So if you grant a user access to a project, what you're essentially doing is granting them an access to the key for that project or the certificate for that project, so then they can decrypt those values. So if the user doesn't have, if you haven't granted the user access to the certificate, they can't decrypt any sensitive values, and the views will automatically hide that data from them.
So one of the big things that's new, one of the scenarios that the catalog and the server enable is project deployment. But before we talk about this, I actually want to tell a story. So it's one of my stories about the good old days. And even though this isn't something that I usually get to talk about, for an integration services session, back in the 90s during the dot-com boom, I actually founded a software company, was the development manager for about 30 developers building ASP applications. So not ASP.NET, not MVC or any of the new stuff, but actual classic ASP. And the best thing about ASP development was that each one of your ASP files, it had both your markup and your script code in the individual files. And as a developer, you make a change to this one file, and if you want to update it on the server, all that you need to do is take this one file and just copy it up to the production server, and bam, you've got new functionality just like that, like the easiest deployment ever. And if there's ever any inconsistency, it's really easy to figure out, because all that you need to do is to copy the files from the production server back down to each developer workstation. And it was the best deployment story. Said nobody ever, right? So why am I telling you this ASP story today? Any guesses, Matt?
Because it's actually very similar to the package deployment model, or the model that we used in 2005, 2008. Right?
So essentially, in my mind, the project model, the project deployment model that we've introduced in 2012 is like deploying an ASP.NET application. You've got your DLL and a couple other files that you put up to the server, and it's all this one consolidated thing. You have this one consistent unit of deployment that is the entire application and not all of these little individual files that go up on their own willy-nilly, and it's difficult to track. And the reason that I point this out is that we actually have people with startling and frightening regularity ask, why can't I do single package deployment using the catalog? Why have you, Matt Mason, because they're usually asking him, why have you not given me enough rope to hang myself with?
Yes.
And the answer, of course, is because we love you. But the package deployment, which is still around, is pretty much similar to what we had in the bad old days. And my analogy is that it's like the poison apple. It's like the witch from that movie with the princess who fell asleep. And, you know, it looks all sweet and red and enticing, but as soon as you bite it, you're doomed. In the old model, which we won't talk about anymore after this, you needed to plan everything out, and you really had to do all of your dependencies, anything that was external to the package, you had to know about in advance and design for before you started development, way before you even thought about deployment, because if you didn't do it, by the time you got to deployment, you were doomed. It's a lot of D. Whereas project deployment, it's great. So this is, other than parameters, probably my favorite thing. This is what makes me wish that I was out there doing consulting again, just a little bit. So design time and deployment time. We have a first-class concept of a project. We have ISPAC files, .ispac. The one real contribution that I made to the 2012 release was calling these ISPAC instead of ISPAC files.
Does anybody out there actually call them ISPAC files? I'm just wondering if that actually caught on. One person?
Okay, so, sir, you get a T-shirt tomorrow. So we have these ISPAC files, which are the deployable unit, the compiled version of the project. Does anybody know how an ISPAC file is implemented? Raise your hand. So the one intelligent and handsome gentleman up front here. So basically, it's a zip file, just like the Office 2007 and later documents are really just zip files that contain a folder structure with specific XML stuff in them. We use the same basic approach where this ISPAC file is a zip file with a different extension. It has all of the individual package files in it, as well as connection manager files, parameter files, and then a metadata manifest to sort of tie the whole thing together. So we've got this one whole thing that is the entire package, very similar to what the build output from a traditional software project would be. And in my mind, this is probably one of the most significant things, is that software engineering, you know, if you think about the software development lifecycle, as an industry, we've been doing this for, what, five decades, six decades now? We've learned a lot of lessons, and the ad hoc way of throwing things together simply doesn't work anymore. In the real world, if you're writing code, you have source code control. Whether it's TFS or some other product that's out there, nobody writes code. You know, even when I'm doing code for my own pet projects, I've got it checked in somewhere. Those best practices and those patterns that are pervasive for traditional software development, we need to remember as ETL professionals or as data warehousing professionals, we're doing software development. It just happens to be ETL packages.
Right. So quick review, quick summarization of this stuff. So the main things that we did in 2012, we went from this group of random packages everywhere. You had the concept of a project at design time within Visual Studio, but that went away once you went to deployment. Our DBAs were reporting that, or the people managing the packages, they never knew if they were getting everything they needed when they moved from one environment to another, right? You want to decommission a server, you're not exactly sure if you have all the pieces that you need. And so we moved to this project model, right? So you're in Visual Studio, you compile down, you get a project that becomes your deployable unit, and that's what you deploy to your SSIS catalog. The other thing we simplified was the configuration model, right? So configurations in 2005, 2008, they were implicit configurations. So a package would point to a configuration file and it would load, it would reach out, and then those values would be pushed in. And the configuration is basically a path to something within the project. We made this model more explicit in 2012. Now we have parameters, right? You can look at a package and you know exactly what that package needs to run. Package says they need a server name, they need a batch number. Right? And parameters are essentially read-only variables that are used within your package.
Yeah. One of the things that really leaps out at me for the bright red box in the bottom left-hand corner here is that XML path. The configurations basically are tightly bound to the internal implementation of a package. So it's backslash, package, backslash, container, 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 task, property, etc. And one of the things that I saw at multiple clients when I was doing integration services consulting was a pattern where the developer had built a package, created a configuration for that package, which enabled them to run it in another environment. So this is where your location independence comes from. And then later on, they were doing cleanup, and they took sequence container one, and they renamed it to something that was meaningful and useful, which is a great thing in general, but because of the way that configurations work, two bad things happened. The first one was that the value wasn't getting set where it should have been getting set, because the path changed, right? Because it was based on the internal implementation. And the second thing was, until SQL 2008, it failed silently. It was a warning. It wasn't an error. So when did you learn that the package that you had deployed into your production environment was actually pushing data into your development server? Yeah. You learned it when someone yelled and wondered why the data warehouse, why the numbers on the CEO's report were a month old, right? And if you have to worry about SOX or other regulatory compliance issues that say who has access to what data, that's a resume generating event potentially. So my workaround in the old days was to have a set of package level variables, so they're at the root of the package namespace. All configurations would set values into those variables, which would then be used elsewhere in the package via configurations. With parameters, we have both implemented that in a formal model, so we've got a formal interface for the package. We have tool support inside of Visual Studio so that it's easy to do the parameter to expression. We parameterize property expressions and it just works. And the experience is the same from development time to deployment time. And perhaps the most awesome thing, going back to my client horror story, you can mark parameters as being required so that unless a value is explicitly supplied for a given parameter at runtime, the package just won't run. It's like, hey, you need to supply this. I know I have the default value that the developer used. That's not good enough. I've been marked as required.
So when 2008 came out, we asked our MVPs to submit white papers about any pain points that they wanted to do, and we got 4 white papers on how to do package configuration and deployment. I think Matthew actually wrote one of them. All 4 had different best practices and different ways of doing things. They're all really valid. But anyways, when we were designing in 2012, we went around and actually looked at the different best practices, and that practice of rather than having your configurations pointing randomly in your package and declaring top-level variables and configuring those, and that's how we actually led to the parameter model, so the best practice that Matthew had defined. We don't give him credit for it, but it was probably one of the things that influenced our design for parameters in 2012.
So, it's actually at the review cycle for Microsoft, so I might have to send you a review feedback request so that you can give me credit for this retroactively.
Right?
Is that posthumously? In any event. I want to reiterate this. The ICE pack file, that binary file that gets created when you compile and deploy a project, we store that file. We don't parse it out. We don't have, so we do parse out some metadata. But we actually store that ICE pack file as a binary blob inside the catalog database. Remember that the built-in encryption functions inside T-SQL only work with data up to 8,000 bytes. Projects can often be much larger than that. This is where we're using the SQL CLR and that system.security.cryptography namespace, but with the same key structure as everything else to have that project binary encrypted and secured inside the server. So we've got our ICE pack file. So I love this because it has the projects, got the parameters, got all the shared connections and so on. It's the thing that gets deployed. And it's time for a demo, yeah. I think. So when we actually go to deploy a project, what happens? I ask jokingly, what doesn't happen?
Eight.
Thank you. I can't actually see the numbers, but there we go.
There we go.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That doesn't look like T-SQL. What is that?
Yeah, so I'll actually start off. I've been using PowerShell. Any PowerShell users out there? Okay, good number of people. So I've started using PowerShell more and more. I actually set up all my demos with PowerShell now. So within 2012, we have full PowerShell support for the SSIS catalog. So this script is what I run before I do a demo. It basically installs a new catalog for me, so it provisions a catalog, it deploys my project, it creates a folder structure, it creates environments, it sets in variables, it sets references, basically sets up my entire demo environment for me. So I'm just going to run that real fast. You see it's doing cleanup here, removing the previous catalog, it's deploying a new catalog instance, it creates a folder, deploys my sample project, sets up my environment, and now I'm all done.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
So this is all great for demos. Who would, in the real world, so people who do real work in real companies, who would need to automate the creation of a standard environment? Can anyone think of a reason for this? I'm hoping everyone raises their hands. It's sort of a trick question, right? So setting up a new dev machine, setting up a new machine in your cluster, having this consistent environment is really vital for pretty much any mature, repeatable software process. So for those of you guys who saw through the ruse, congratulations.
Yeah. So within another way to deploy your projects to the catalog, of course, is the way developers will most likely do it, is through the SSIS designer, through SSDT. I can right-click on my project node, click deploy. And that's going to bring up this deployment wizard. So it's remembering my previous settings because I've deployed this one already. Otherwise, I could browse and deploy it to a specific server.
And is this the same project that you deployed with PowerShell?
This is the same project I deployed with PowerShell. I'm going to deploy it in a number of different ways because I want to show something. So I deploy, and one thing I'd like to call out during deployment is this one right here, this changing protection level. This is where we go from user key or whatever the current protection level is for your project to server storage. Because remember, encryption is handled for you automatically on the server. So this gets rid of those annoying cannot decrypt because mismatch of user key type errors you get with SQL Agent. Okay.
So there is a hand up here. Yep. We'll take one question, but we're going to ask questions in general to be saved for the end. I forgot to give that disclaimer earlier, so shoot. Yeah, the first words that you said?
Privilege.
So yes, there is SSIS admin database role?
So the question was about permissions, what permissions you need to deploy to the server. There's a couple of different roles. There's SSIS admin as the super user, but there's also you can grant access to deployment or to deploy to the folder. Different user groups can have access to different folders on the server. So there is a set of server-based permissions that you can set. And the users will only see the folders they have access to deploy to. Okay. Yeah, there's another. I don't think we cover that here, actually, or maybe in the appendix slides.
We've got some of that in the appendix, but it's not going to be in the talk itself.
Yeah, we'll talk about the different roles and things like that. Okay, so I've deployed here. I want to show one more way of deploying. This is deploying straight with T-SQL. Okay. We actually had a demo where we were running a SQL profiler in the background. We still have it open from before, actually. We thought it would be a good idea to walk through this and show all the different statements that get run during a deployment.
We only had 75 minutes.
Yeah, this is an exercise you can do yourself to see exactly what's being run when you do a deployment. But this is an example here. I'm actually running a stored procedure called deploy project. And I open up, I'm actually reading my project binary directly from the file system with an open row set. And then I deploy it to my catalog using T-SQL. So let's run this. Need to reconnect. And it ran my query. So now I've actually deployed that project three different times. I wanted to show a thing called versioning on the server. So this is just running a SQL statement. I'm selecting from one of our public views, the object versions view in the catalog schema. And this will give me list those three projects that I actually deployed. I can see my previous version history. Of course, I can also browse to my SSIS catalog through SSMS. I'll right-click on my project and click on the versions values, and I can actually see these versions here as well. Okay, and one thing I can do from this, I can actually roll back to previous versions. Okay? This does not mean this is a replacement for source control. That's the first thing I hear. It's like, oh, we don't need TFS anymore. Like, no, this is not a replacement for source control. This is more of a rollback of a failed deployment or something broken in the environment, a bad deployment. You need to roll back to a previous version, and you can do that here.
Yes, it's a safety net, not a crutch.
Yes. So to actually roll back, it's pretty simple. You just say restore version. Like Matthew said, we actually store the entire project binary on the server underneath, right? So in essence, this is just moving a pointer back from the current version to the previous version. And you can set a maximum number of versions on the server. You're going to run a package.
Well, I was going to, but this one has a required parameter, and I don't know your demo environment. Well, there we go. So the thing that I want to show, since he was in a dialogue, this is one of my absolute favorite things. It makes me go, ah, like an idiot whenever I see it. Just like in like the backup database dialog or any standard Management Studio dialog, if you are performing an operation such as executing a package, you can graphically set things like parameter values and then say, script this to a new query editor window, and when you choose I'm obviously not qualified to use Management Studio. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, you need to.
Didn't I choose execute? No, okay, no, I'm gonna stop doing this because I'm eating time. But you can generate scripts and then use those as starting points to customize the scripts, to add them to your own little toolbox, things along those lines. Thank you very much, Matt, for not being a flake. So having something like this as a starting point, in my opinion, I've been known to say at parties that if I were stranded on a desert island with only one programming language, I would want it to be T-SQL, which explains both the beauty of T-SQL and the fact that I don't get invited to parties very often. But having the ability to do all of this server control, be it validation, execution, what have you, directly through Transact SQL, I think is one of the strongest aspects of this model.
Right. Yeah. One of the things when we were designing this is we wanted to make it, like, we talked to different customers and there was a variety of roles about who actually does the deployment and management. In some environments, it's a DBA type, right? Somebody who owns the database, they do all the deployment and monitoring of packages. Other environments, it's an ops person. They don't actually have access, they're just point and click and they just do the deployment. They have minimum rights to the actual server. Or it could be an IT person, it could be a developer, right? There's lots of different roles, and so we tried to make it as flexible as possible. You can do all your deployment through T-SQL. There's a command line utility if you want to run to do your deployment. There's the PowerShell, right? So we provided all these different ways to interact with the server, so different users, different roles can pick whatever works best for their environments.
And one of the key things is that it does fit into your software development lifecycle as well, so that separation of roles or separation of responsibilities is a key part of a mature development lifecycle, and having the ability to have a development team create something which is then handed off in a standardized way to a deployment team, which is then once deployed, managed by someone in an operations team. For a lot of smaller and medium-sized businesses, this may be meaningless overhead. For a lot of larger companies, it's a requirement for them to do their jobs.
Okay, let's switch back.
So there's the demo. So basically what happens, Matt mentioned that we went through and were walking through a SQL profiler trace. If you do this, some of the things that you will notice is that we're explicitly saying execute as caller. Everything is being done as your permissions. You need to have the right permissions, the right privileges to deploy into the folder that you want to. We're opening and closing and managing the symmetric keys as made available by the database. In order to secure the data and encrypt it as we are deploying. When we're done, we actually issue a wait for. We wait for a second, then we do a validation to make sure that everything is completed. We are putting data into our projects table, into our object versions table, which is one of the things that Matt was showing, and into the packages table as well. The only binary that we're storing is the ICE pack itself. We don't strip out the individual package files and store them as binaries, but we do have metadata for the individual packages. And we've got stored procedures such as encrypt binary data, deploy the project, and append the packages as well, where these, the latter ones, are actually parsing through using the SQL CLR code to pull the metadata out of the ICE pack file to ensure that during the deployment, everything is consistent and it's all wrapped in a transaction. And it's awesome because it's in the database. But the question remains, is there a happy medium? And the answer, of course, is no. It's because they talk to ghosts, and ghosts are so depressing. But people keep asking,
it's like,
people keep asking, why can't I do, or how do I do, these single package deployments? And I had originally started talking to Matt saying, okay, you know, we know that we can do it programmatically. There's an API, and we can do this and that and the other thing. And by the time that I had finished trying to convince him to have us give you the rope to hang yourself with, I had talked myself out of it.
Yeah, so that when we were designing this feature, it was very contentious, because I know in 2005, 2008, deploying single packages is actually a very common thing that people do, and people want to do it. And there was two camps on the development team. There was a bloody battle. Like, do we support the single package deployment, or do we force the full project deployment? I was on the wrong side. I was on the losing side. I was trying to fight for customers doing the single package deployment, and talking to MVPs and seeing the best practices and what single package deployment, the problems that it can lead to, like, you know, handing you the rope to hang yourself, I became convinced that the full project deployment is actually the easier way to do it.
Yeah.
And so to support, usually people want to do a single package deployment because they have a single bug fix they want to do, right? They have a running application, they don't want to redeploy everything, they just want to deploy a single bug fix.
I only changed one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it works on my machine.
Yeah, so why not deploy to the production server? There's nothing could go wrong with that, right? So the better approach is to use general software development best practices, life cycle, right? You have multiple code branches, right? The minimum number of code branches, or well, a suggested number of code branches is about 3. You have your development branch, integration branch, and a release branch. And as you do development, right, you do these periodic integrations between the branches. If you have a bug fix, check it in dev, it gets moved down to the integration environment, and then finally it'll be moved to release once you sign off on the fix. Right? And all your deployments that you do come from a build, a nightly build, however you kick off your build. Your integration goes to a test environment for testing, the release goes to production environment here. If you follow this pattern, it means that every one of your builds is reproducible. You can go back at any point in time, you know exactly what your ETL application, what set of packages were running on a server at that point in time. Keep in mind, all the builds can be automated. You can run Visual Studio from the command line in an automated way to spit out the SSIS binaries. The SSIS project format doesn't support MS build, but there is an extension on CodePlex that will add MS build support for SSIS packages. So you can actually do your deployment and you can actually do your build and deployment through MS build with this thing on CodePlex. And there's a number of ways to automate deployment, like I just talked about, PowerShell or T-SQL and things like that. So in general, when I talk to customers and they say, I need single package deployment, we talk about this, and they realize that this is usually a better model.
So one of the things that I did when I was a consultant is when I was doing initial meetings with a potential client, I would actually ask them about their software development lifecycle. And keep in mind, this is like, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, so this is quite a while ago. But if there was a customer that was not using source control for their development, which was still pretty common in small market at the time, and wasn't willing to adopt it as a prerequisite, as a consultant, I would not take their money. I would not work with those customers because I knew that, you know, down the road, be it a month or 6 months or whatever, everything would hit the fan, there would be problems, and it wasn't going to be manageable. It was pain that I did not need. Having this approach, where all of the developers are working from a standard TFS or whatever repository, and then having that promotion or the path to promotion, where when you check into the branch, we have a build, we have standard tests that we can run against it. We can then make statements about that particular build. We promote it on. We run additional tests on it. When we're confident that that build is ready to go, we move forward. We have a one-off change. Oh, this one package needs to be changed. Well, that's great, Because we have this known good baseline. Yeah. We have this thing that we're incredibly confident that it works because we have this rigorous process around it. And since we're only changing one thing, then we will change that one thing, and then we will run our tests, and then we will promote it, and we will run our other tests, and we will push out that one package that has changed as part of the overall project, and we'll do it with a high degree of confidence. And it might not take the 5 seconds that it would take to copy your one DTSX file up there, but it is probably...
a lot safer.
And probably won't take that much longer either for most customers, for most deployments. So another bucket of pain is logging and the concept of server execution. So what goes on when we run a package? So I have another story, another good old days story. I'm not a good clicker person today. There we go, the good old days. So I would work with different customers. I'm learning about integration services as I do this, and different customers have different needs. Some are a little more heavyweight, some less so, but I found myself building for each new customer, for each new project, for each new ETL application, a logging and monitoring infrastructure where my template packages would have execute SQL tasks. Here, I'm going to insert a row saying I'm running the package. Inside the data flow, when I'm doing the heavy lifting for the package, I'm populating some variables with row counts and other status information. And when I'm done with the control flow, I might do an update, you know, whether it's success or failure, to update to say that the execution is completed. And I did this over and over and over again. And as I started working more and more in the community, talking to MVPs and other professionals out there who knew much more than I did, I found that they were doing the same thing. I've probably seen literally 30 or 40 people who have all invented practically the same thing, and it's the same thing over and over again. I think it was Matt who was telling me a story recently. You know, you talk to people about integration services, like, oh, I can move this data from here to here, and I can get the whole thing done in like 2 minutes. It's awesome. It's this great productivity tool. But then for all the other stuff that I actually need to make it work in the real world, oh, that's a week. You know, the data movement is 2 minutes. So what Integration Services Server does in 2012 is it takes that common pain point, that common bucket of pain, and it addresses it through the communication between the catalog, the SSAS DB and the components therein, and the IS server exec host process. We've got the one instance, we've got the one running database instance with a single catalog database in it, and we've got however many IS server exec processes as we have running packages. Or I shouldn't say that, because one execution could have multiple packages inside it. So each running execution gets its own host process. And they talk something like this. So notice we've got green for a SQL connection and blue for named pipes communication. So as a general rule, if SQL Server needs to talk to that host process, it's going to use a named pipes communication, so inter-process communication channel that gets set up by SQL CLR when we're calling create process. So this is basically a place where they can talk back and forth, both for requests for information. It's like, hey, give me your performance counters. Oh, here they are. Or a request to shut down. I've received a request to terminate. Or why don't you create a memory dump for me, or a debug dump, something along those lines. The green arrow, that SQL connection channel, takes advantage of the fact that even though IS Server Exec is part of the product, as far as the database is concerned, it's just another client. It's a Windows process, right? And it's doing stuff. And when it's doing its stuff, it wants to let the server know about it, because the server, the catalog, has tables where it can write information such as, I ran this task and it took this long, or I've moved this many rows through this path in the data flow. So the execution process, IS Server Exec, will actually use standard SQL connections and ADO.NET to push this information back into the catalog, and all of the things that we used to build into our packages through whatever framework, we either built it ourselves or we bought it or we found something in the community that worked, here it just works.
And so, actually, if we go back there, we actually did make a change in 2012. Package logging in 2005, 2008, it was a synchronous process. So if you're writing a row out to a SQL server with a SQL logger, execution waits until you finish writing the row and then continues. So if you're doing a lot of heavy logging, especially to a remote SQL server, it can really affect performance. So we changed that for the IIS catalog logging. It logs asynchronously now. So basically we queue the log messages. We guarantee that they'll be written in the right order, but we queue them so execution can continue while the logging is going on. So if you have verbose logging enabled, you might see sometimes that your package execution actually finishes before the logging finishes, because it's still catching up. The timestamps are right. We traced the timestamps for the time that was actually thrown, or the event, either the event was thrown or the log message was written. But we will log asynchronously.
So to look at the server execution in one last view, essentially, as we saw in the script that Matt created, we're going to call create execution, passing in the path to the project and the package. We are going to set whatever parameter values we need, referencing the execution ID that gets returned from create execution. And then we call start execution. When we call start execution at this point, we're actually going to, through the SQL CLR, create the instance of IIS server exec, and then start receiving events from it. These events are going to be written primarily into catalog that executable, written into internal, because we're talking to the internal schema, but they're being exposed through catalog that executables and catalog that executable statistics.
So one thing to recap, when you're creating an execution using T-SQL, it's a three-step process. You call create execution, which is going to give you an ID. You can then set your parameter values or set any options for that execution, like changing parameter values, creating data taps. We'll talk about that later. And then you start the execution. So it's always a three-step process.
So we have a quick review of the server architecture. So we started off at the 30,000-foot view. This is probably the 10,000-foot view. So we've got the two primary components. We've got SQL Server on the left. We've got the host process on the right. We have the initial execution being created by this create process as user. This is going to spin up IIS server exec, pass along to it the project and packages that need to be executed. The named pipes communication will take place for the back and forth communication, and the ADO.NET channel will be used for the execution host process updating its status. And when it's done, all of the information is being stored here inside the database and accessible through the reports that are included with Management Studio. So,
actually, one thing I want to talk about that creative process. So in 2012, we have real server-based execution. Through SSMS, when you say execute package, in 2008, it would run locally, right? It would actually download the package and run locally. In 2012, it will kick off a remote execution. One thing you need to be aware of there is the double hop, the Kerberos double hop problem, right? Like, you tell the SSI server to launch a package, it can impersonate you. However, it can't establish connections to remote machines as you. That's called the Kerberos double hop. For that to work, you need to set up delegation within your environment. Beyond the scope of this topic, but something to keep in mind. If you're ever trying to do an interactive execution with SSIS and you're getting cannot connect as anonymous, that means you need delegation. Another way around that is to use a SQL agent job to run your package instead, because then everything just launches right on the server and there's no double hop. It's only a single hop from that point.
And for most scenarios as well, setting up the credentials on the server to run the SQL agent job is going to be the best practice anyway. You don't want someone going in. It makes for a great demo or a one-off, but you don't want someone going in and manually triggering
and executing
a package
everyone.
In a production.
Yeah, that comes up most when people try to validate. One of the new features in 2012 is you can connect to a server and validate that all of the parameters are set and that the package is properly configured, but that does an interactive execution. So unless you have delegation set up, the validation might not work.
So another thing that is common, sort of falls into the same bucket, is monitoring. So when the package is running, what happens? So how do we tell what's going on?
And so one of the key things in 2012, one of the things that makes it easier is that your logging is automatically captured on the server, right? This has been one of the big pain points for SSIS. One of the parts of our, well, we talk about the learning curve, and SSIS is learning walls, right? It seems really easy, then you hit a wall when you get to deployment. It seems really easy until you hit a wall when you get your first error in production and you have no logging enabled and you don't know why it happened. Right, so SSIS has that built-in logging at the designer. When you run within Visual Studio, everything you get the nice messages. You run with DT exec, you get the nice messages. You run with SQL agent, and you have no messages to look at. So now all this logging is automatic when you run on the SSIS catalog. You don't have to modify your packages. It just works. And at the catalog level, you can control what logging level. It's pretty basic. We tried to keep it as simple as possible. So there's a no logging error or none. In this case, the only thing that gets logged is that the package execution occurred, so the start and finish. Basic logging is what the default is. This is what you'll want to use for most of your scenarios. This picks up all messages except for custom messages. So certain tasks and transforms can throw custom event messages. Those ones aren't picked up. It doesn't pick up diagnostic events either. Performance is a special logging level that you'd use for doing perf analysis of your packages. So this level is actually capturing all the performance details at the data flow level. You can get a breakdown of how much time is spent per transform and per phase within your data flow. It's very useful for benchmarking your packages and trying to find bottlenecks. Finally, you have verbose. Verbose captures absolutely everything. It can have a lot of messages, especially if you're using OLEDB, where there's a lot of diagnostic messages that are put out. You typically only enable verbose logging when you're trying to do troubleshooting. Yeah, you wouldn't have this running all the time for your packages. There's a pretty big performance overhead for it. All these messages get sent into the SSIS catalog. And there's a set of built-in reports within SSMS. If you right-click on the catalog node, you can see there's a dashboard. You can drill down. There's a lot of more information in there. So these built-in reports, and like I said, these reports run against views in the SSIS catalog. And they're accessible to you. You can do your own reporting. On the right-hand side there, it's showing a sample query that you could run to pull out the detailed execution, a breakdown of all time spent per component. If you're running with the verbose log level, you can also capture row counts. But the trade-off is you need to be running verbose to actually capture those counts.
Yeah, and one of the things that as a longtime T-SQL developer that I love about the catalog is the fact that all of the data is in there. It's accessible, using your favorite or my favorite programming language. But I've also seen people, MVPs or potential customers, who are working with tools like PowerPivot, where they're building PowerPivot models on top of SSISDB, so they can just do slicing and dicing inside of Excel without needing to write queries. And it really comes down to what tool that you're most comfortable with that you want to use. The key thing here, of course, is that it's in the database. It's in a relational database, which means that it's fair game. It's easy to get to.
So I'd say that for most customers, the built-in logging is probably all you need. But we also support some custom logging solutions. There's some third-party things out there. It's like I said, all the messages are in the catalog and views. If you have an existing logging framework, right, in 2008, you might be doing your own custom logging. You can continue to use that in 2012. There's a new system-level variable called server execution ID. So you need to update your logging framework to log that, and that's how you can link the SSIS catalog logs to whatever custom logging that you're doing. Right? You can actually link those two things together. Jamie Thompson, a longtime SQL MVP, he's the guy I learned SSIS from reading his blog, he put out an SSIS reporting pack. This is a set of reports that run against the SSIS catalog that you can use to integrate into your own reporting systems, build your own dashboards. They're a very good starting point. They have some very interesting features and functionality in them. I'll give you examples of how to build your own reports.
Yeah, the two things that I love the most about Jamie's reports that are up there on CodePlex, first of all, it's this SPSSIS catalog stored procedure. As he's refined these reports, they've been around for probably a year and a half at this point, since he was working with the beta bits for quite a while. But he found that he was solving the same problem again and again and again, and he has this highly parameterized stored procedure that gets back a pretty significant subset of the data that you would want to report on from the catalog. The other thing that I really appreciate about them is that it makes me feel good about my report design skills. As Matt said, they're a good reference, they're a good starting point. You may not want to show them directly to your customers.
Right. I'm sure Jamie does that on purpose to make people feel better about their own reporting skills.
Yes. Yeah.
And finally, if you haven't seen this, Pragmatic Works is an exhibitor down in the pavilion. They have an add-on, they have a tool called BI Express, but part of the thing is an auditing framework, an auditing wizard that adds some additional enhanced logging capabilities. Very interesting tool to check out if you're looking to go beyond with what comes out of the box in SQL 2012.
Yeah. So the third bucket of pain that the server addresses is troubleshooting. So I've got the packages, I've enabled logging, I've gotten them deployed, but I have no idea what's going on. Something is going on, but I can't tell. So this is a story, and this one I won't go into too much detail unless you buy me a drink at some point during the week, because it's this sad. But basically, big customer, packages in production, once every 2 to 3 weeks, Wednesday night, the package that will normally run in 2 or 3 minutes, you know, moving a couple tens of millions of rows, so, you know, it's tuned, it's performing, et cetera, every 2 to 3 Wednesdays, it's always a Wednesday, but it's not predictable, it just stops. It's like, well, what can we do? What is it pulling? We're looking at the source data or the data in the source system. Nothing is obvious there. We actually want to see what's flowing through the different paths in the packages, because this is, you know, an adoption blocker. It's a project killer. The customer is very unhappy. They don't know what the actual problem is. And what do we need to do? Well, we didn't have 2012, so we actually needed to take that package and the data flow that was failing and add multicast for each of the primary branches in the data flow to dump that out into temp tables or work tables that we'd created so that we could see at each one of these phases what data had got in before it choked and blew up. We just didn't have insight into it beyond that. What did I learn? I learned that in order for me to get a new version of this package into their production servers, I had a 6 to 8 week change control process because the changes needed to be reviewed by these people and approved by these people and then promoted and then these tests run and so on and so forth. You know, it's a real enterprise environment. It was a good reason for it, but it essentially meant that in order to get the diagnostic information that I needed, I couldn't, and the reason for it was because prior to SQL Server 2012, there was not a mechanism for me to get insight into a running deployed package without modifying that package unless it was designed for answering those questions at the beginning.
I have a quick side story. We're working with one customer where their packages would randomly fail once every couple of weeks. They couldn't figure it out, and it would go down for like the whole overnight batch window period. And they didn't. Yeah, they had people on call. They'd come in, try to debug, and it would just start working the next day. They didn't know what was up. It turned out that one of their machines that they thought was a production server was actually running on somebody's laptop, and that person would every once in a while take their laptop home for the night, and it would break their entire ETL process. Yeah, that was great.
So we've come up with a few ways to make it easier to find out what's going on inside of your running packages. One of them is this diagnostic EX event. This is, first of all, only available in verbose, and second of all, focused on giving insight into the relationships between a running package and its child packages. A very common pattern is to have a master package run, which will spawn off additional worker packages. Sometimes it will spawn off multiple instances of the same child package in parallel or inside a loop. And if you're looking at logging data, if you're trying to figure out what's going on for the multiple instances of child package 1.dtsx, it's often not easy to do that. So to come up with something that is both usable and generic and flexible, we actually have information that we're storing as an XML blob, but you can flatten it out, parsing it using cross-apply in T-SQL to pull out those parts of that blob that you're interested in. The thing that is most interesting to me from a troubleshooting perspective is the fact that we can look in and see which parameter values are being passed into which parameters for which instances of a given running child package. So if you know that this master package is spawning 10 different child packages, some of them multiple times with different values, perhaps pulling from different folders or connecting to different databases, how are you going to find out what's going wrong? This is a key part of your arsenal.
Another thing you'll notice that we've changed in 2012 for logging is we log the iteration of a loop. So if you have a for loop, for example, and you're looping through, you run the same child package multiple times and it fails on the fifth iteration, you'll now know that it's the fifth iteration. The log messages will actually have an iteration count in them after the name of the container.
So one other thing that we have, which we've alluded to a couple times, but we haven't explicitly called out, is the ability to capture performance counters for our running IS server exec host process instances. So using this execution performance counters table valued function, we submit it to the catalog, which uses that named pipes connection to go out to the server, gets the results sent back over the same named pipes connection, and we can get a full set of values. The most interesting thing for me is the number of rows that you've read in and the amount of memory that's being used, but being able to see what buffers or for the, what am I trying to say, the thingy, the spooling.
The buffer spooled. If you're ever doing any sort of pipeline or data flow tuning, the most important perf counter is buffers spooled. That's the number of buffers that SSIS couldn't fit into memory and had to page out to disk. You always want that to be zero.
Yeah,
if ever you're paging to disk, it means you need to change your data flow so that optimized.
Thank you. Even though I couldn't pronounce it, even though I'm looking at it on the slide in front of me,
the
analogy here is this is basically as if your car could report, I'm doing automotive analogies again, if your car could report the number of flat tires. One isn't okay. Anytime that you see this as being something other than zero, that represents a critical problem that needs to be investigated if you care about the performance of your packages.
So quickly about execution time. So we're about 5 minutes left, so I'll rush through this. But this is a feature we added in 2008. You can actually create and force an execution dump of a running process. And what this does is creates two things. One is a memory dump file, which probably won't be that useful for you unless you're an expert in assembly or you have access to the Microsoft source code for this. But it also creates a text file with a textual description of all the variable values in your package, all of the current property values, the last 10 different messages that were logged, things like that. So you can get a really detailed analysis. This is really more of an advanced troubleshooting thing. Typically, you'll do this when you're working with CSS. Customer support will ask you to create a dump, and then you send it to them. So we supported this with DTUtil in 2008. You can, for a running package, if it's hung, for example, you can force it to dump. You can also, it's a parameter for DTExec. You could say dump on the first error. And in SQL 2012, we also support it through the SQL interface. So you do, for a running package, you can say create execution dump and give it the execution ID. And that's going to send that signal over the IPC pipe that we talked about earlier to tell the process to dump out. And that dump file goes to a secure directory, the error dumps directory, because, of course, it is a full memory dump, so it could contain sensitive information. So I believe by default it's a the default ACLs on it should be limited to box admin, I believe.
Yeah. So this error dumps folder is something that during the SQL Server setup process we set a restrictive NTFS permissions on it so that only administrators can access it.
Yeah.
Because we need the ability, basically we need a more secure place to put things in there. This is the one standard location. So when you're saying create execution dump, you don't get to specify the location. Which is kind of like,
data tabs is another advanced data tab functionality. It's kind of like a data viewer on the server. You don't have that view, like I'm showing the package view, but basically what you can do is, on the server after your packages have been deployed, you start an execution. You say I want to create taps on these paths within my data flow, and when data flows through those paths, they get written out as text files to a secure location on your server. Right? This is meant to address the issues where developer says, well, packages work for me fine in my development environment, but the dev doesn't have access to the production environment to do live debugging. You probably don't want to do live debugging against your production environment anyways, but this lets the DBA set these things, run the execution, view the data, make sure it's something the developer can take a look at, then they can load it and debug it in their dev environment.
Right. So for my troubleshooting horror story where they had the 6 to 8 week delay for change management to get a new version of a package into production, this would have saved the bacon if it were available in that time frame. But the fact that we have the same secure location, so basically we can add a data tap, run the package, the CSV file, so all of the records that flow through those paths that you specify, they get dropped into the same secure folder as the memory dump. And as you can see down at the bottom here, we also log the fact that someone had created a data dump. So if someone has permission to do it, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the business right to go in and access the data itself. So there's auditability or... Oh, you were the one who
I was doing it because you have a minute to cover your final slide.
Oh, there. We're dueling here. So these things, which I'm not going to read, these make me wish that I was back in the field doing what you guys are doing today. The changes that have been made in integration services around the server in SQL Server 2012, to me, address the pain points that I ran into day after day after day as an integration services consultant. Project deployment, specifically parameters, the fact that execution is now server-based and remote. We have this beautiful T-SQL API, and the catalog has all the data in it. So. Yeah. We just do want to point out that when we are done here, we are heading down to the expo hall. We're both going to be at the booth until 4.
Come see us in the power hour tomorrow.
See us at the power hour tomorrow. And have a great show. Make sure you fill out your evaluations, please. Thank you very much. 1 second, Matt.